This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is August 6th, 2020, and this is episode 201.
I'm Scott Delunnebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. Hey, so apparently Larry Plotnikoff, who is the son of Serge Plotnikoff, whose music you just heard, listens to the podcast. And Serge is very happy to know that his song is still being used. That was the comment we got on our website today. Did you know you can leave comments on our website? Politicos.ca. Go leave us a comment.
I did. Not many people do, but you should go leave more. Let us know what you think of the show. And, you know, if you know the people who write our theme music, even better.
On today's show, we talked to Thay Shear from Evidence Democracy about scientific integrity in BC, and we dig into the latest political fundraising numbers. Thanks to the 101 people who contribute to the show every month to help us keep making it happen. Join them at patreon.com/politicoast. And a big shout out to everyone who joined us online for our first Facebook Live show. We couldn't do our 200th episode in person, so we did it via Zoom. Thanks to Julian Stead and Stuart Prest for joining us. It was a good one. Go listen to it and watch it, I guess. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. First up, let's jump into our interview. Does the government listen to its scientists? Well, joining us on Politicoast from Evidence for Democracy is Thay Shear, one of the co-authors of a new report, Spotlight on Integrity, that looks at the state of science in British Columbia, which is something I think we're both pretty big fans of. So, Thay, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So this new report comes from the group Evidence for Democracy. For those who haven't heard of it, what is E4D?
Evidence for Democracy is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that broadly focuses on trying to promote evidence-based democracy and evidence-based policymaking. We do three types of work. Our first is issue-based campaigns. We also do education programs that include training tools, and then we do research programs. And oftentimes these cross over, like in the case of this current study, it's mostly research with a bit of issue-based campaign thrown in.
So you have a new report out, Spotlight on Integrity, as well as there was a previous report, Oversight at Risk, both focusing on public sector science and specifically members of the Professional Employees Association. Can you give us a better sense of who these scientists are and what their job is and why they're important?
Yeah, so essentially we worked with the Professional Employees Association, which is the union that represents some of the scientific professionals in the public sector. And largely what these scientific professionals do is work on the science generally in the natural resources sector or forestry and departments like that. But these are the scientists that are monitoring your natural resources, monitoring the environment, doing work sometimes even in public health, where they are the basis of making the policies that the government uses. They are keeping our environments healthy, they're keeping our public healthy, and they keep the economy going. So they're important as they're the backbone of what BC's policies are supposed to be based off of.
And so the 2017 report looked at British Columbia and it looked at the, I guess, the freedom and the transparency within public sector science. You weren't around for the writing of that report, but I'm sure you read it and know it fairly well. Could you just kind of give us the broad overview of, you know, what was the motivation for that report? What did it find? You know, what were the concerns that came out of that in 2017?
Yeah, so on a broader scale level, E4D came about during the Harper era and was motivated by sort of the muzzling of government scientists that was going on at the federal level, is that it informed a lot of our earlier work leading to the 2017. And at the same time, there were concerns about external professionals within the working with the BC public sector, and there were incidents that had led us to do this with the Professional Employees Association, a survey of the scientific professionals. And essentially what they were trying to find was like, what was the state of the scientific integrity in 2017? And broadly, what the big conclusions were there were that there was this concern of over-reliance on external professionals. There wasn't enough internal research capacity for the scientists to be doing the work in-house, so they were going to external professionals. And oftentimes, there wasn't oversight of these professionals, and there was sort of conflict of interest, and this was leading to problems. On top of that, there were also concerns about the ability of scientists to speak to the public or speak to the media, and also just the ability of them to do their own job and if they had the research capacity to complete the work at the highest level.
So that was the last report. This one, the 2020 report, can you give us a brief overview of kind of what the high-level things you learned from it were and who you talked to get that information?
So we did a follow-up survey, essentially, in 2020 with the BEA again, and we got around 300 responses, which is pretty good. And our broad scale one was how we look at scientific integrity is we've split it up into three main categories. So the first is research capacity. Like that's all the things required to do research that can be knowledge, that can be the people working, that can be time. The second pillar that we look at is communication. Scientists should be able to communicate to the public and also to policymakers. And the third is the science should be independence. There shouldn't be interference and science should be able to be done with independence. And largely what we found was there were concerns for all three of those categories. There wasn't enough broadly research capacity for scientific professionals to be completing their work to their mandate. The mandates were clear, so they knew what they were supposed to be doing, but there was large concern that they didn't have enough internal research capacity to actually complete the mandates. So that hits that first pillar. The second pillar of communication, even though they were largely allowed to go to conferences and professional development and to talk to the public, the problem was due to the lack of research capacity, they didn't have time. And oftentimes they were doing this on their own time and they didn't have funding to do this. And the third thing with regards to independence was that scientists perceived, even though that people were coming to them for their advice to make these policies, they also believed that the ministry's ability to develop policies based on the best available evidence had been compromised by political interference. Close to 43% of people surveyed believed that. So there's obviously concerns that science was happening with interference from politics. And what we're looking for is that science is done and then given to the policymakers, and then they use that in their decision-making process with transparency. So we can see how the science is used in the final decision with all the other considerations that go in. And right now, it's not clear if that's happening. So then we, from that, made 8 recommendations. 4 were related to research capacity, 2 were related to communication, and 2 were related to scientific integrity and independence.
So we'll come back to the recommendations because those are really interesting as well. I want to kind of dig in a little more on this research capacity question. One of the things your report brings up is how much our capacity has, I can't put it another way, but been gutted since the early 2000s, like big 25% reductions in staff size over the years. And it seems like what you found is there hasn't even been, within the past couple of years since your previous report, a significant effort to return to those larger numbers or even increase the capacity. Now, I get that government always looks or is always eager to try to keep costs under control, but what does this affect? What do these public sector cuts really mean in terms of our government's ability to get good evidence?
Essentially, if the internal capacity isn't there to do the research, then the government isn't getting the best available evidence and the best available advice to make their policies. The scientific professionals are working for the government, so they have the BC's public interest at heart. Like that's part of their mandate, that's part of their job. So having them do the work internally means that's going to be for the public good. Unfortunately, when they don't have these resources, that's when they go to external professionals. And external professionals have their own oversight mechanisms and things like that. But when the oversight professional or when the external professionals give their reports back to the government, sometimes there isn't even the capacity or the knowledge to be able to provide correct oversight to that. So even if we're getting outside people to do it, we can't even look over it to make sure it's correct. It's something that we saw come up a lot. So essentially, just the whole thing falls apart if we're not getting the best available science. The policies might not end up being the best available evidence, and that all just tailspins from there, essentially.
So in order to correct that lack of capacity within the government, would this be more of a direct funding thing, or is this a staffing issue? Like, obviously, staffing has funding implications, but would we be able to correct this just by giving the existing scientists more resources, or is this going to require significant expansion of public sector scientists in general?
So it's we kind of come at it from both angles in the report. We don't specify like what would potentially solve it, but in our recommendations, we have identified that right now there's a lot of vacancies. So jobs that are filled or are supposed to be filled are being delayed filling. So even like if they were hiring, if they just filled those vacancies, then they'll have more research capacity. Another thing that came up was that there was a lack of succession planning. When people were retiring or leaving, there wasn't the transfer of knowledge to the new person taking over the job. And that obviously loses a lot of institutional knowledge and reduces that research capacity. And these are all things that if you put in place hiring policies, hiring practices, and succession planning, that you can very easily increase the research capacity without having to make like significant funding additions. Like this is already there. You just need to fill in those vacancies and develop plans for it. On top of that, we do recommend that there might need to be increase in support and technical staff for the ministries. A lot of the researchers, the scientific professionals that we surveyed notified us that they were doing a lot of support work and a lot of administrative work, which obviously takes time from the actual research, which they're hired to do. So there is that need also for the increase of researchers in the public sector, but also you can do simple fixes that will help increase the research capacity without having to make those substantial additions.
So one of the things we have seen changed in the past couple of years since the previous report was the passage of a couple bills, largely around professional reliance. And we've talked with in the past with Green MLA and now leadership candidate, I guess, Sonia Furstenow, who I know personally was very interested and championed a lot of efforts to improve professional governance and public professional reliance in the public sector. You know, you talk a little bit about that in your report, maybe just for listeners, how have those moves improved, if at all, scientific integrity in the province?
From our survey results, we didn't really see a shift from 2017 to 2020. We asked the question that was, has your research capacity improved since 2017? And it was mostly split 33% or one third for no change, increase, and decrease. So we haven't seen it from the people that we're surveying. And largely that is because the bills that were passed were more focused on the first two recommendations from the Haddock report. So Haddock made a report in 2018 where they made 121 recommendations. And the bill that was passed, I believe Bill 49, was more to do with the external professionals themselves than with regards to the internal research capacity of the public sector science. So the bills might be successful in what they were doing, which was making an office of the superintendent of professional governments and then clarifying the roles of non-government professionals. But that we didn't see that translate into a change in research capacity, or not one that we could substantially pull out in the eyes of the people that we surveyed.
So let's move on a bit to the communications and training. How has that situation evolved since the previous report?
Again, we didn't see a lot of changes since the 2017 report, and that followed in the communication. We saw that people were largely allowed to communicate with the public, albeit with permission, but we didn't see any sort of major shift from the previous results in 2017.
What kind of steps do you think need to be taken to improve that freedom to communicate?
One thing we saw a lot in the results was that people weren't sure if they were allowed to communicate or when they're allowed to communicate or whether or not they had permission to do something. So one thing we recommend is that to have clear scientific communication policies. so that you can reply to requests to speak to the public or speak to the media in a timely manner, and that the average employee has access to these policies so that they're able to understand what they're allowed to do and who they have to ask to do something. These policies will also clarify to everybody on the outside, like what's allowed. And then once we have that sort of information, it's easier to make direct recommendations of how to improve these policies. But right now we are seeing from the people that were surveyed that they weren't even sure whether or not they were allowed when they were asked. So that was leading them to just not do it. So obviously we need to have clearer outlining of what is allowed and what isn't allowed. And then from there, you can make more clear recommendations.
You'd mentioned professional conferences and professional development for and how many of the scientists weren't able to take advantage of those and travel to them. Has that significantly changed?
Not since 2017, no. We're still seeing that they are allowed to, in theory, to go to these things. But it is, again, that lack of research capacity that leads to them not being able to have the time and the funding to actually attend them. So most of them, I think we have a stat in there that a substantial amount felt that they were missing out on advances in their field that were occurring at these training and conferences that they weren't able to attend. 42%, I believe. So we also recommend that there should be some sort of policies for increased time off and funding to attend these sort of professional developments and conferences.
If they're ever allowed to go back to conferences post-pandemic, that is, of course.
Yeah, and also that, because conferences are starting to go virtually now, maybe that will ease the financial burden to go to this, but it still leaves the time to have to like set up a presentation or go and watch all the talks. So it might be a little easier now with the sort of virtual things that are coming in, and we'll see how that shakes out. But it actually makes it, I think, easier to now get to conferences if you don't have to take like the funding and stuff to get there, although there will still be conference fees.
I want to switch to the section on independence, and your comments earlier about political interference are really interesting. Looking at these poll results or your survey results, it's almost a 2-to-1 factor of people of your respondents who said their ministry's policies have been compromised by political interference or the ability to develop those policies. What kind of examples are we talking about? Because this is a pretty possibly concerning issue for people who care about evidence-based policy if, you know, the ideology is overtaking, or even just other political factors are overtaking the science.
Yeah, so we had some follow-up questions, and we also had open comments. So we went through all the comments and pulled out things that were coming up over and over again. And what we were seeing were sort of the entire spectrum of what you would consider political interference. There were data that people were being pressured or felt they were being pressured to not present because they were detrimental to industry. And then there were reports of even at the highest level, just like key legislation being significantly changed in response to industry pressure. And also MLAs not liking the repercussions of certain policies. So trying to get the best practices overturned were two of the examples that we pulled out in the report. We also have 25% of scientific professionals having knowledge of information being suppressed or declined by their ministries, and specifically leading to misleading impressions by the public, industry, or government officials. So we're seeing that it's happening at the highest levels, but there was also reports of just managers and sort of a culture of pressure to not go against what is expected of them with the data. So if there was data or results or policies that they thought were against what was expected, then there was sort of this culture of pressure that people were reporting. Not everybody, I should say, but from the people that were reporting this, the 43%. Those are the types of stories that we were seeing.
So since the previous report's been done, there's been a change in government. Do we have any indication whether or not that's had an impact on this, or whether scientists were feeling more pressure under one party or another?
We didn't directly ask that question, but we did ask the question about the change since 2017. As we saw with the sort of one-third split, there are some people that are finding that there was an increase in research capacity. So maybe there are changes due to the new governments that aren't being seen like evenly across all the people we surveyed. Because we do have a range of departments and different types of jobs that these scientific professionals are doing. So maybe in some cases they're seeing an increase due to the government change, but people were also reporting a decrease. So it's hard to tease that out, and we didn't directly ask in this survey.
I want to pivot a little bit. And one of the things you bring up in the report is how Evidence for Democracy has been involved in campaigns at the federal level. We don't need to go through all of that work, but I'm curious what changes, because, you know, you mentioned the famous war on data under the Harper government versus Trudeau running in 2015 really on a evidence-based platform or using those that language a lot. Trudeau brought in a chief scientific advisor and a number of changes. What lessons can we take from the changes that have happened or not really happened at the federal government and import into BC, do you think?
One of the ones that we specifically point out that the federal government had done was create model policies on scientific integrity that I believe all of the science-based departments at the federal level had to have in place by the end of 2018, I believe. And so now that they are in place at all those scientific departments or science-based departments. And essentially, they're quite comprehensive documents about that just lay out the rules for understanding what the role is of both the government and the people working at the government, the scientific professionals, and how we can, what the policies are around communication and research and maintaining that integrity. And that was very much done, I believe, directly in result of the Trudeau government being elected. Obviously, there's that's just one thing, and we need to understand if that had any sort of impact. But as long as if the policy is in place, then you can start worrying about whether or not the enforcement of the policy is in. And currently, we recommend making similar policies, so covering that sort of scientific integrity and also science communication at the BC level. And then it's like they have the model policy on the website for their departments to use. And it'd be very easy to adapt that to a British Columbian context. And also, it wouldn't take all that many more resources to get that into place. And once you have that sort of contract in place, then you can start understanding whether or not it's working or not. But first, we need to get to the point where these rules are laid out clearly so that everybody knows what they're doing and they're out in the public.
So in terms of the recommendations, what do you see as the major obstacle to actually getting them implemented?
I think getting them to the having the pressure from MLAs to make these changes. I think most of these changes are common sense once you understand what the problem is and everybody agrees that they would solve the problems. The problem is that with so much going on, especially now, it's up to the people to get the information to their respective MLAs. And the more MLAs that are pressured to sort of make these sort of policies and enact these recommendations, and the more that they see that there is this kind of public support for public sector science, then the ball starts rolling at that pace. So definitely the biggest problem that I see is just making sure the politicians know that there is this will to get these recommendations and to support the public sector science.
So you released this report in June, and I imagine did much of the work earlier in the year and did writing in the midst of the pandemic. What is the influence of that? Because this is a situation where, you know, public health officials, Dr. Bonnie Henry, is on live stream every day and has been kind of the face of the province. Is this a positive step towards trying to recenter evidence in our democracy, or is it kind of highlighted different issues that might need to be taken up?
I think largely we believe that it's been a good thing, that it sort of puts it to the front and center in the eyes of the BC public, what public sector science can do and the sort of decisions that can be made at that type of scale and how they can personally impact people's lives. And I think keeping that in the center is what's going to lead to sort of getting the ball rolling and having these recommendations in place. And especially if you look at the success of BC in comparison to other provinces and also to the south, to the states, you can see the difference of using the political or the public health scientists and the information and directly translating that to the Canadian public and specifically in BC. We can see all the different ways that different countries have reacted in real time, and you can see the different results that have happened. So from that, we're hoping that people see the benefit of public sector science and then use that going forward as a way to talk to their MLAs and talk to their representatives and make sure that they know that this is something that the BC public wants to strengthen going forward.
Are there any recommendations in the report that we didn't cover so far?
I think we covered most of them. So they're about hiring practices, succession planning, increasing the competitive of hiring practices. One thing that we saw was that people were being enticed essentially by going into the private sector due to like a lack of competitive wages and career laddering paths. So we have two recommendations on that. The rest, I believe we went over with regards to communications and training and then scientific integrity policies and transparency policies.
Great. Well, if listeners want to support these recommendations, what should they be doing?
So Evidence for Democracy has set up on their website, evidencefordemocracy.ca, a tool that you can use if you live in BC to contact your MLA. Essentially, you type in your postal code and it links up which MLA is representing you. And we have done a pre-written email that kind of goes over what I've been saying today and reiterates to your MLA that the public wants support for public sector science. The email is editable, so you can add your own personal message. But if you don't want to do that, you just click the submit button at the bottom of the page and it'll send it to your MLA and you'll get a confirmation email.
So one final question I have is, presumably there'll be another report in 3 years' time, another survey. Is there anything that kind of piqued your curiosity from the initial responses here that you'd like to ask more about next time? Kind of, what are the questions still remaining?
I would like to ask more specific questions about political interference. We had some specific ones about like knowledge suppression, but the range of responses that we got in the comments to the political interference raised issues that it would be useful to have more survey data on. We obviously couldn't anticipate all of the range of results, but now that we have that going forward, you can start to refine the survey and specifically ask about who is doing this. Is it the manager? Is it the people above them? Examples like that, so that we can provide more direct recommendations on how to prevent political interference. Other than that, it would be interesting to see how things change even after the pandemic and during the pandemic. But obviously, if we do it in 3 years from now, the world might be a very different place. So it'll be very interesting to see how this goes into the future with regards to public sector science. Hopefully, it leads to a place where we have strengthened policies and strengthened support for our public sector scientific professionals.
All right. Well, we'll make sure to put a link to that action tool and the report itself in our show notes, and people can find those there. Are there any other links or, you know, where can people follow you if they want to learn more or just get your opinions on things on the internet?
Yeah, so Evidence for Democracy has a Twitter account, E4DCA, and we also have a Facebook page, Evidence for Democracy.
Thank you so much, Thej, for taking the time this evening to speak to us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice of you to promote our work.
Moving on to segment two, Orange is the New Green. We got fundraising numbers this week, and the NDP is doing well, but the Liberals certainly are not. So the top line numbers are the BC NDP raised $757,000, the Liberals raised $283,000, and the Greens raised $142,000. So pretty big gap there between first and second in terms of fundraising haul.
And compared to Q1, both the NDP and BC Greens are up in absolute dollar amounts. The NDP raised almost $80,000 more than last quarter, and the Greens almost $37,000 from last quarter. But the BC Liberals took a nosedive, dropping $355,000 versus what they made in the first 3 months of the year. The NDP picked up almost 1,000 new donors versus the Liberals and Greens, who just led donors. The Liberals lost over 3,000 donors, and the Greens actually managed to make that extra money from basically half as many donors as they had in the first quarter.
So I'm not surprised that the Liberals are down in fundraising, I'm a little more surprised the others aren't. You know, it's pandemic, massive, you know, near Great Depression level drop in economic activity and a recession late. I'm actually surprised anyone's holding steady in these circumstances. I would have expected a significantly bigger drop for everyone.
Yeah. The NDP have clearly had a very strong fundraising game for the past 3 months. I mean, the majority of that uptick was from small donors, those giving under $250 whose names aren't reported. There's 846 additional donors in that range giving an extra $84,000. So, you know, that's the bulk of where the NDP's money is coming from. The Liberals are a little more split. They take about 100 to from the 100,000 from small donors versus 175,000 from larger donors. And the Greens are a smaller donor party as well. You know, it's not surprising, like you say, with the pandemic to see a lot of people not giving. And I think that's where the Greens and Liberals got hit on number of donors. Credit to the Greens fundraising machine for squeezing more from less in this case. You kind of lose sight of the fact that they lost so many donors when their fundraising numbers are actually flat to slightly up.
Yeah, so the Greens are also doing a leadership race right now. I don't know their exact structure of how the fundraising works on that, but usually parties will take a cut of fundraising that the official candidates managed to raise. So that may be helping boost the Greens' numbers a bit.
And the other thing of note here is the per vote subsidy is still in place. The NDP takes $760,000 from that for the last quarter. The BC Liberals just shy of $800,000, and $332,000 go to the BC Greens. And that was to help the parties transition off of corporate union donations and onto smaller individual donors. There's only going to be a couple years left before the per vote subsidy goes away. It's going to drop slowly down from where $2 that it was to $1.75 per vote. So all of these parties are going to have to really build up their individual donor game. And right now it seems like the NDP is really leading that game.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. And usually the party in government, especially when they haven't, you know, worn out their welcome yet, generally post the better fundraising numbers. So not entirely surprising there. But what is notable is the gap. It's just such a large divide between where the BC NDP are and where any of the other parties are. And, you know, that can't be comfortable for the Liberals or their leadership right about now.
Definitely. I think we've talked in the past about some of the more detailed year-end financials for each of the parties and how they hint that there might be not actually a lot of money in the tank for the BC Liberals. Their income may just be paying off the expenses they have, let alone any debts, versus the NDP are starting to bankroll, you know, fill their coffers. And I can't quite remember where the BC Greens are. I think their expenses are actually quite low, so they're able to operate that tight ship and put some money away. But, you know, this may be one of the first times we really have the NDP going with a significant war chest advantage over their opponents. And that, I think, has renewed consideration of what we started to talk about last week of a potential fall election. Like, if you're John Horgan's team right now and you look at these fundraising numbers, do you just go, this looks like the perfect time?
I think it would be a bad decision for the exact same reasons we talked about last week. If anything, this will just make it look more opportunistic. And also, like, you'll expect the party to raise a bunch of money during an election. So, like, the Liberals might be able to play catch up a bit during the campaign. And overall, it's just not a good idea to run a fall election. And I can't see how that's changed in the last 7 days.
Nothing sparks anti-socialist donors like the threat of a NDP majority, I guess.
Yeah, you'd expect to see a lot of those fundraising emails coming out of the Liberals. And yeah, because like that's really what they have going for them right now. Like, they haven't had a good message or really been able to settle on something that works outside of the people who are already pretty on board with them and, you know, hate the NDP on principle. There's nothing that shows any indication they're going to change that and fits those deficiencies.
Yeah, I also don't see any significant advantage that the NDP can pull from an election right now. Like, their best case scenario is taking a majority, and that gives them 4 years unimpeded. At the same time, they can just continue for the next year fairly smoothly. Like, the numbers are still tight, but they're not so tight that things aren't getting passed. Now, if Andrew Weaver decides that he's too tired or too many other obligations in his life to continue in politics, that could upset the numbers a little bit, or any other number of resignations. But at the same time, you can coast for a bit, and there's a lot of levers that you have when you're in government that you risk losing out on. So I can understand the temptation being there, but I have trouble seeing how you sell it as anything other than opportunistic.
Yeah, and voters have often punished the opportunistic politicians who call election. And the other thing to think about here is, like, there's no sign Andrew Wilkinson is fixing his issues at all, and is, you know, finding a way to actually connect with British Columbians or going to be in a better position to run campaign in a year from now's time. And in the meantime, like, I'm hearing rumors of growing dissatisfaction within the Liberal Party about their current leadership. So, you know, maybe not a terrible thing from the NDP's perspective if it drags out a little longer and that discontent festers a bit. The Liberals have a lot of work they need to do to fix up their party and put them in a position to run a strong and competitive campaign. And they're not there yet. And I haven't seen much indication, unfortunately, that they're going to be in that position in the near future.
Well, I guess we have the rest of the summer and a few more weeks in September of continued speculation. Hell, it may be just continued speculation until we hit whenever the scheduled election's supposed to kick off, October. I guess the election would be October 2021. So until next fall, we'll be speculating. Let's jump into quick takes. First thing we want to talk about is more fundraising numbers. The federal ones are out as well. I don't think we have as many thoughts or opinions on these. Second quarter fundraising shows that the Conservatives pulled in about $3.5 million in direct donations, and they pulled another almost half a million from their leadership campaign transfers. CBC compares this to their 2018 numbers, which they note that it's hard to compare their 2019 numbers because of the election year. And in 2018, they pulled over 6 million, so a drop of almost a half. The Liberals similarly bled fundraising compared to 2018. That year, they had pulled in 3.1 million in Q2. This year, just 2.6 million. But I think one of the underreported stories is the NDP increased their fundraising federally to 1.3 million. The Bloc Québécois went from 42,000 in 2018 to 131,000 this year. So apparently, the Bloc is back. Who knows?
Yes, I mean, but both of the Bloc and the NDP, like, they were not in good shape 2 years ago. So they really only had up to go. So yeah, the Conservatives are one of the rare parties that flips the thing where parties generally do better when they're in power versus out of it. But that's because they have a fairly effective small donor operation, which has its own drawbacks because it constantly incentivizes them to, you know, write the most, you know, outraged fundraising emails about every little slight that they perceive from the Liberals. And that in turn has given them a, you know, party that cried wolf problem, which, you know, I think we saw with all this wee stuff that's been going on is, you know, when you say that whatever's going on is the biggest scandal in Canadian history, you can only do that so many times before that no longer has an impact and people tune it out. And yeah, it may help them a bit in terms of getting a bigger war chest, but on the bigger narrative level, I think their focus on that small donor fundraising and the incentives that are inherent in that has actually probably hurt them more in the long run.
Best reason I've heard in a while for a stronger per vote subsidy system. I think both of the major parties here, you know, they're showing the challenge faced by trying to fundraise in a pandemic when so many people were out of work or struggling to pay their own bills, let alone worry about fundraising for political parties. You know, many of these parties have taken the federal wage subsidy, and justifiably so, because they want to keep their staff on board, and those staff shouldn't lose their job just because of a downturn in the economy. So, you know, things will still be ongoing.
Yeah, people like to shit on political staff, and, you know, they may be as unpopular as politicians, depending on the day of the week. But since we all kind of agreed as a country that, you know, people shouldn't have the, like, employee-employer relationship stuff, there's no reason why political staff should be exempt from that. So, you know, it's reasonable that it also goes to political parties.
On the polling side, despite these fundraising numbers, it shows that the Liberals still hold a fairly commanding lead, according to the CBC poll tracker. They have a 52% chance of a majority if an election were held today, and a 45% chance of winning the most seats. They're just shy of 37% of the polling average, although that is down 3.7% since last month. So perhaps we is really taking a big chunk out of them.
Oh yeah, I think it definitely is.
Those votes are kind of spilling all over the place, which is why they still sit in such a commanding spot. You know, just under 1% goes to the Conservatives to bring them up to 29%. 1.7% goes to the NDP, bringing them up to 17%. And the Bloc gets almost a point to get to 7.4, and the Greens are at 6.4. So no one has a strong enough position to challenge the Liberals, which is kind of their ideal situation to be in, I guess.
I think they'd be happier if their poll numbers weren't slipping. But they have some, you know, room. They can slide a bit more, but, you know, it can't be comfortable seeing the trend lines. But speaking of uncomfortable trend lines, BC has released its greenhouse gas numbers for 2018. Total net emissions were 66.9 million tons of CO2 equivalent, which is a net increase of 6% or 3.5 million tons from 2007. You know, not great on that front.
It's particularly not great on that front, as that 2018 number is an increase of 2.6 from 2017. So things, yeah, are still pretty high. The press release notes that Clean BC and all the programs included in it were announced in December of 2018. And so those only started being implemented in 2019. So even our 2019 numbers probably won't really start to show the effect of our climate change initiatives beyond the carbon tax and some of the existing programs. I think this is one of the things the NDP and Greens really campaigned on, and especially with their CASA agreement, was taking strong action on climate change. And, you know, any government takes a few years to see the effect of its policies, which is always fun because governments can switch before you even know if their policies work. It's too soon to say that Clean BC will or won't have the effect we need it to have. But these numbers aren't optimistic because we needed to have been taking a lot more action for a long time. And we still have a giant LNG project being discussed up in northern BC that we haven't really figured out how to account for. And there's kind of a gap remaining in Clean BC to cover the last little bit of emissions to get us to where we need to be. So that's all extra reasons to worry.
Yeah, plenty of work left to do on that front.
Hey, but at least a giant shutdown of the economy this year will actually mean good things for our emissions. You know, silver lining there. And we haven't had as many forest fires yet, which helps.
Yeah, although it's been a while since I actually looked at kind of the initial estimates for 2020's emissions, but I think they were only down something like 6% globally was kind of the initial numbers I was seeing back in April or something, which kind of goes to show, like, even when you grind the economy to the halt a lot of ways, it's hard to meet climate targets that way. And, like, I really think it does mean that we have to build our way out of this. We can't just rely on, you know, cuts to human activity. We got to figure out how to do the human activity in a cleaner way rather than just scaling it back.
Well, from climate emissions to maybe something that could have a positive knock-on effect, who's to even say? We're in the midst of a renewed trade war with the U.S. suddenly as Trump restored 10% aluminum tariffs to imported Canadian aluminum, citing national security concerns again. And the Canadian government announced a dollar-for-dollar retaliation on unspecified U.S. goods that are going to be subject to countermeasures.
This just really seems like one of those things where, like, Trump is flailing around trying to, you know, recreate the greatest hits of what he thought got him popular last time. And you know, I guess trade wars are one of those things, even though they've never worked well for Trump at all.
I'm not even sure the point of the tariffs this round.
It's far from clear. And like Canada is, you know, literally like the least or the smallest concern possible on U.S. for the national security. Like it's a bullshit rationale. BS the last time, it is still this time. It's Trump being Trump with his incoherent policies.
What was nice about the last round, and not really nice, but smart at least, was Canada's approach to targeting industries based in Republican-governed states. And I imagine, I suspect, we might see something very similar again, since it's a way to put pressure, at least within the party, to not support Trump's actions.
Well, if we're going to be super strategic about it, we should be targeting stuff from swing states on that.
Then you risk Republicans say they're going to get even harder on Canada. There's no winners in this.
I don't think that's super likely. I think the bigger problem is like Wisconsin is a swing state, and we already have such high tariffs on cheese. Like how much more of a trade war can we fight on that?
It's a mess.
Yeah, so hopefully this is short-lived and gets resolved before Trump gets voted out and Biden comes in. But with this stuff, who knows? But speaking of somewhat questionable behavior from the head of state or their stand-in, Governor General Julie Payette is still in the news, this time regarding some odd goings-on at Rideau Hall and renovations and rules around who can and can't be around the governor general. So this is reporting from today that discusses how the governor general apparently, or Rideau Hall on her behalf, apparently spent $140,000 to design a secret staircase that never got built, so the governor general could enter and exit unnoticed.
It's a bizarre story again.
It really is.
At least, you know, at least with this one, unlike the previous time she was in the news, there's not, you know, allegations of harassment and abuse. This one is just weird and kind of funny, although it is a gross misappropriation of public funds, potentially, as it discusses essentially $250,000 being spent at her request for increased privacy and security in a number of ways. CBC basically got a hold of a National Capital Commission report that discussed a number of the projects she wanted that were requested to be completed, including the staircase you mentioned. There was $117,000 on various gates and doors to keep her office closed off to other people. Apparently throughout this time, like it's 3 years into her mandate and she has of her 5-year mandate, and she still hasn't moved into Rideau Hall because these renovations haven't been fixed. CBC reports multiple sources saying she doesn't want to have maintenance workers in her line of sight. She doesn't want to be able to see RCMP officers outside her office. They should be hidden down the hall, and only specific staff should be able to actually get into her office. It's all a bit bizarre. Yeah. And the cost of it is like, you know, they note in there how typically they're, you know, there's usually a bit of a budget for renovations during a changeover because it's a good time to do them. But usually it's like, let's update the paint and make sure that any maintenance work needs to be done, not spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on major overhauls.
Yeah, you're right when you call it bizarre. It's just such a weird story. And like, she's apparently been living in the guest residence at Rideau Hall rather than Rideau Hall itself, which kind of odd. And I don't know, the thing about not having RCMP present, like, I wonder if that's changed after recent events or not, but having a RCMP protective detail, it's just something that comes with the territory of being governor general. as does all the other public facing stuff and having a bunch of staff around. So, like, it's a weird thing to be a sticking point. And I don't know, did the Governor General not know what she was getting into when she agreed to this?
Yeah, that's how the CBC article really finishes off, is speaking to some political scientists on the, you know, this is a very public role and you can't, like, people deserve their privacy, of course, but when she's sitting at her desk at work, I don't know that she should be able to expect the same level of privacy that she might otherwise in a different role. I don't know. It also, it's feeling like there's people out there who really have it out for her, right? You know, two major story scoops for CBC on these questions. And that's not to say it's an unjustified attempt, but there's definitely like an effort.
I'm not sure to have it out for her. Like, okay, you have the story about the harassment allegations at Rideau Hall. That seems like it came from people at the hall who went to the media or kind of reported on that or wanted that to get out there. Fine. And then this, well, seems to me more likely, oh, there's a big thing at Rideau Hall. Let's take a look and see what else we can find out about what's been going on there. And this got uncovered in the process. So I think categorizing as the media having out for her, maybe a little unfair to the media on this one.
Oh, I wasn't suggesting necessarily the media. It might be someone within Rideau Hall. And I'm just speculating.
But like, it seems to have a lead fairly directly from like obvious bad thing that you want some public accountability for, and then, you know, just sequential stories that come after that from reporters doing what reporters do.
No, and they're well-reported stories, so definitely give it a read and try and see what's going on there. You know, hopefully we don't see too many more stories coming out of Rideau Hall, because, well, it's a very public position. It's one that I think Canadians appreciate generally forgetting about until we need a ceremonial head of state to do something. But let's finish off by talking about the COVID alert app that has come out. The federal government released this in the past week, largely targeting Ontario. And I think it's starting to be effective here in BC in the Maritimes and will be partnered with provincial health agencies over the coming months. I've personally been generally rather skeptical, cynical about contact tracing apps on your phone, partially for privacy concerns, partially for whether this will be effective and whether it will just replace public health agencies doing the groundwork of actually making sure there was transmission and not just like two phones were on the opposite side of a wall from each other.
Yeah, you need to make sure there's enough reliability in the system and coverage too, that there aren't going to be gaps or people getting too many false alarms or not enough alarm when it should be going out.
But at least on the privacy side, this app has gotten the seal of approval from the various privacy commissioners. Michael Geist, a fairly prominent tech and privacy writer in Canada, says he's installed it. And a lot of people are just saying, hey, the federal government did this right for a change. So the app doesn't record anything personal about you. It simply uses your Bluetooth on your phone and will look to see if someone else's phone has it, who's nearby you for at least 15 minutes. And if it does, you just exchange, your phones exchange Bluetooth codes, which are not personally identifiable. And then if either of you ever enter a code you get from the government, if you get a positive COVID test, it alerts the other people using the app who exchange your Bluetooth code. So it doesn't tell the government anything about you, anything about where you've been. Like, the worst that could maybe happen is if someone back engineered it, they might be able to see that this phone saw those other phones. But even then, it's de-identified from like the Bluetooth app to the phone itself. So overall, it seems pretty good.
There was something I saw a little while ago where some data scientists were able to show that with like very little data from like a couple of different sources, as long as one of those was geotagged, you could actually get or figure out a huge amount of it, even if like a bunch of the stuff was anonymized and track individuals. So I mean, there may be some like edge case concern here with, you know, enough data on like from like very big companies or something. But yeah, for the most part, it does seem like a pretty reasonable balance on this. And on it, yeah, this is a situation where, because of the crisis nature of the pandemic, the balance maybe needs to be less on the privacy side and more on the just maximizing effectiveness of these measures.
And I mean, the number of apps that I have on my phone that are tracking far more than this, you know, I've lost count of, you know, I run an Android phone. Google knows a lot more about me and I give it a lot of permission. So overall, I think this was done well. My skepticism is mostly assuaged. Its effectiveness will be partially reliant, at least, on people, you know, downloading it and installing it. So do go out and look at it. COVID alert app. Just search that in either your Google or Apple stores. I think there is some issue with version control. If you have an older phone, it might be an issue. And that becomes one of the key accessibility issues that people are starting to talk about. Like, if you can't afford the latest generation phone, you might not be able to get this app. Luckily, we know that BC Public Health and other public health agencies are not going to be solely relying on this. It will be one of many tools in the toolkit to help us combat COVID-19. But, you know, I recommend it. Go get the app at least.
Yeah, not working on older phones is concerning, especially considering how long it took them to roll this out, because we're, you know, several months into this now. But nevertheless, like, if it was a choice between them rolling out now with only the latest phones or rolling out, you know, in another month or two, the balancing on that, I think, significantly favors doing it now and trying to have the immediate impact and then patching the deficiencies versus trying to get it perfect before taking action in a crisis. And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.